I hope you're enjoying this big exclusive via the Judge Joe Brown Show. Don't forget to subscribe to this channel. Now, back to the show.
All right, so guys, the audio, and when we come back, we'll talk.
And let's carry on this discussion. It's important. Joining us now via Zoom is psychology expert and life coach, Dr. Cheyenne Bryant. Doctor, thank you so much for joining
us. Good morning.
Good morning. It's so good to see you, especially on an issue of such importance. So as we just heard from our piece, there's a stigma in communities of color for reaching out with any issue of mental health or mental illness. How do we get past those barriers so that we can give folks the tools they need to reach the help, to seek the help they need?
Yeah. Good morning, Melvin. Good morning, Giselle. And happy Monday. You know, one of the tools that's really important is we need more people who look like us in this field. There's only 4% of psychologists that are Black in the mental health field. And obviously, I'm one of those 4%, right? Why is that important? Because cultural competence is top of importance when it comes to African Americans, specifically males, going to seek help. It is very important that they see someone who either looks like them, understands them, and allows them to be in their authentic form when expressing the traumas that they've experienced that has gotten them to a place of depression, a place of anxiety. And another reason for that is when you don't have folks that understand the culture, that leaves African Americans to be either under or overdiagnosed, right? That means that they can then run the risk of being mismedicated or undertreated. And that is a big issue for a community that already does not have access to healthcare. And as we know, healthcare disparities have been an ongoing thing in our community from the beginning of time.
Yeah.
You raised such a great point. This whole idea of cultural competency. I studied human development and counseling in graduate school, and this is, you know, such an important thing that we talked about a lot, especially in multicultural counseling, that this is the way to reach people, and there's a very specific way that you do that. Because every cultural community has different issues. So what tips can you share with folks to help them be able to prioritize their mental health?
You know, Melvin, I'm going to make it as simplistic as possible because that's another thing that we...
Yeah, I'm going to make it simple, too. I'm going to let her answer that question, and then I'm going to bring in Judge Joe Brown. So what's the answer to
you know... To the simplicity, this is the thing, and I always say it, this is in the mental health field, and this is especially in the health field overall, and especially in the political world. I don't like politics. I like policy. I always say that. The issue with the folks who are in leadership positions is that they speak a language that only their constituents can understand. When you are serving a group of people, whether it be in the health field or politics, and I happen to be in the mental health field, you have to make sure that you're speaking a language that they understand. You're not there to impress them. You're not there doing the Spectrum One, a Eyewitness Channel 7 news interview, you know, Judge Joe Brown show, where you're speaking in a way where you want to, you know, you want to show that you do have an expertise in your field when you're dealing and providing information. The whole point is that the audience and the folks that you're serving are able to understand it, receive it, and apply it. And so that's very, very important. And what I was saying is that when you're dealing with your clients, you know, when I'm speaking in clinical terms, they have no idea what I'm talking about. And if my clients don't understand it, what benefit is it to them? Number one. Number two, you know, the folks in leadership, the therapist, the life coach, the doctors, the medical doctors, we have to have awareness of self. We have to have a connect between reality and perception. Reality is our reality, and perception is how the folks we are serving our patients and clients are perceiving us. Okay, they already look at us as a doctor. That is already a pretty powerful position to people who are coming to you to trust you for your expertise and for what you do to help them live a better quality of life. You have to make sure that the conversation is tailored in a way where they feel safe enough to ask for clarity from you. But for the most part, you should be able to speak to them in a nature that they understand and also ask follow-up questions and say, does that make sense? Do you understand that? You know, is there anything else you need? Are there any last thoughts? But that is not just, you know, professionalism. And coming out of the space of wanting to be the expert, but it's coming to a space of being what we are really here to do with our titles and our leadership and our positions is to serve the people who are we are leading. And a lot of folks are getting caught up in this, I'm Dr. such and such, or, you know, I'm the councilman, or I'm the mayor, or I'm the president, I'm the senator. We understand your title, you know, Mr. or Mrs., ma'am or sir, but we have to understand the policy. We have to understand your conversation when you're telling me that my mental health is decreasing in these ways. What does that mean to me sitting across from you, Dr. Bryant? What does it mean when you say that there are pathologies you see in my family? What the hell is a pathology? And so those type of clarities and that type of conversation is what is missing. And when it comes to particular marginalized communities, for instance, the Black community, it's already a stigma to go seek help for your mental health. It's already a stigma just to go seek help for your health in general. And so when you're dealing with that type of culture, you have to have that competence, because you can and will cause more impairment on a patient or client if you don't have the competence of understanding the stigmas in their culture, of understanding how maybe embarrassed or how judged your client is feeling just sitting in your space attempting to seek help from you. That is our job as professionals. Our job as professionals is heavier than the job as a client or patient. And until we understand that and we take accountability and we take responsibility for what we signed up for, people will continue to be more impaired than they will be helped, healed, or better, leaving you as a practitioner, as a coach, as a doctor, even as a politician or an elected official. Those are things we have to tap into, and we have to stop being so caught up in the expertise, the titles, the celebrityness of it, and do your damn job, which is to help and serve the folks who you are there to serve. And I make sure that with my clients, doesn't matter what race they are, you know, I'm here to care for and serve human beings. It's a human right to have a peace of mind. It's a human right to have health care, whether it's in your body or in your mind. That's a human right. And I am very passionate about providing that human right. And when I have folks who are in session with me, I constantly check in with them. Do you understand what I'm saying? If you don't, make sure you ask me. I'm not here just to be the expert and look good. I'm here to make sure you get what it is you need. And if I'm not giving you what you need, we need to process that. And we need to draw out a blueprint that works for you. This is not about, good job, Dr. Bryant. This is not about, you changed my life. This is about, what do you need to live the best quality of life, which is a human right, and how can I help you get there and drive your agenda, not my agenda and not what I want for you, because I'm here to facilitate you and empower you in the greatness you already have. And that is, for me, what's most important.
Thank you. And I am Valerie Denise Jones, and I approve that message.
Thanks, Val.
I'm in a good mood. But, yeah, definitely watch out, Iyala Vanzan. Here comes Dr. B, because I definitely think that you would do an awesome job doing the same thing. So at this time, what I'd like to do is welcome the man of the hour, Judge Joe Brown, 323-646. How are you doing, sir? Hello, hello, hello. You're live.
JB, where are you?
I am taking myself off mute, ladies. A little slow doing it. Anyway, glad to hear from you, Ms. Jones and Dr. Bryant. It's always a pleasure. You are so erudite, learned, and perceptive. You know, this thing about translating back is interesting. The first time I noticed that was years ago. I had just pledged and gotten into a frat. I'm an alpha. And we would have these meetings, and we weren't that long out of high school, and we were remarking about how difficult it was then to talk to the people who had gone no further than high school that you had already known, and how little they knew and how little they understood, and what difficulty you had talking to your old friends. I remember getting in law school, and I remark on this to law students. I said, a lot of people that you went to college with that didn't go any further, you're going to find it's difficult to talk with them when you start realizing what steps you have taken to get beyond where they are and how they think. And then I used to tell the law students that I would occasionally teach, I said, one of your jobs as a trial lawyer is to translate what you know, what's in the system, the jargon of law and what it stands for, into a fashion where a jury comprehends what you're talking about. In other words, you run down this definition of assault and battery, and you break it down to the jury, Willie went upside Bobby's head, you know, and ooh-weed on it. So you have to do these things, and sometimes you're exactly right. The people who are where they are get out of touch with the people they're supposed to be helping or representing, since you are indeed a political animal as well. We were discussing your immediate intentions, and I'm about to do the same thing myself, so I'm going to help you, and I want you to help me do that. But in that respect, I'm looking at things today where I think so many of our so-called elected representatives represent a worldview that they have become acclimated to because of the circles that they run in, but are no way, form, shape, or fashion representative of the worldviews of the people they represent. So I see a lot of them taking a whole lot of time to disguise their changed worldviews from, let's say, their constituents. Do you see anything like that going on?
Absolutely. And that's where I believe you and I, Judge, talked briefly about how a black person in office, just because their skin color is black and they look like us, doesn't always mean that they're representing us, doesn't always mean that they're pushing an agenda that's going to provide economic development, that's going to provide educational resources, that's going to provide the things that we need in our black communities to thrive and stop merely surviving. And you made a statement that I tagged on to, and I thought, wow, that's exactly right and genius. You said, you know, just because the person is black in office, what does that mean to myself or the black community? Does that mean that I'm supposed to just trust them because they look like me, when there's been a lot of black folks who have been in leadership positions, not just elected official positions, that have, you know, used their blackness to, in the sense of inclusion and diversion, to get to that space or that seat or even that job position, right? But once they got in, that using their blackness came to a halt because of what you just said. Having a seat at that table, once they got in, the culture of that inness changed. And they either subconsciously, purposely, whatever reason we want to put behind it, forgot about the folks who were working to get them in that room, at that seat, and at that table. And now they feel as though they have to speak, think, and choose and push an agenda that doesn't look like or doesn't include even affecting them or benefiting them, nor their lineage or their culture or their background that they come from. So to me, that is a moving part of systemic racism or systemic hardship. Because if you can get people who look like me in positions of power to drive the agenda of white supremacy and white privilege, then guess what? That is more systemically disempowering and disabling than just putting some white folks in position to say, you know what, we're going to keep the door shut to keep those minority folks and marginalized folks out of here. Because if you can put someone in front of me who looks like me to convince me that he's for me, but he's at the table with them who are against us, to me, that's more systemic and pathological and deeply rooted and institutionalized than any white supremacist, white privileged person that you can ever sit across me to tell me dead in my face I don't like your race. I don't like your people, and I won't do a damn thing for them. The other piece,
yeah,
of it being the folks that look like us, is heartbreaking. It becomes distrusting, disempowering, and now you have a community of people, Judge, listen to this, listen to the psychology behind it, who now are creating black-on-black crime. We're not talking about black-on-black crime with just a gun. Black-on-black crime is deeper than just us killing each other. Black-on-black crime is disempowering one another, getting through a door and having to lock it because we don't want you to take the one seat that they gave me. That's a, to me, that's a black-on-black crime. Not making room for my younger black, Hispanic, black, brown minority leaders to come in after me to continue pushing that agenda that helps us. So, again, a lot of our issues are connected, yes, to white agendas, but also a lot of our issues are connected to us pushing their agendas and not even knowing that we're doing it, not having the awareness of knowing it, and some of them up there in power and in seat are aware. Either way, two different journeys, same destination, and it's systemically not working for us.
You know what? You brought up something that I hadn't thought about in a while, but when I was at UCLA back in the 60s, when I got in, there were 145 grad and undergrad students at UCLA out of 62,000 full-time student population. We busted our behinds to open those doors, kicked in a lot of them, as a matter of fact, threatened, hurt, did a lot of stuff you can't talk about because the statute of limitations hasn't run on it. I'm laughing about it. But we got in people, and then we got in a block of 250 black people. They got in, and they did cool. We got in 250 more blacks, and they started doing something that at first we didn't understand. So I basically cornered somebody. So what the hell are you doing? We kicked in these doors so we could get in and get you in. Now you're trying to close them. He said, well, Joe, it's like this, man. We appreciate everything that you guys have done, but we're trying to close those doors because we're looking at it economically, because the fewer black people have degrees from this place, the more valuable they are in terms of their to the marketplace. And we look at this as an opportunity to ramp up our future financial circumstances. Let's put it this way. We don't want to become too common, too many of us on the ground. I'm going to knock you out, fool. And actually, I tried to do it. I got him stunned anyway. Helped him up off the ground and told him what I was really going to do to him if he kept it up. But see, that kind of thing, that's 50 years ago, but that kind of thing's out there. My ex-wife grew up in Richmond, California. That is a hood. It's like Compton. And she used to be all right. And then she got used to hanging around with these multimillionaires and billionaires up in Aspen. And some of these guys would say, Joe, you're bored, man. Your wife's up there doing a heli ski trip. Let's go run to Paris and check out this new restaurant. So I'm going, oh, okay, get a quick bag, get your toilet, man. Run by the house, come back here, park over at my place, and we'll catch the jet. So he's got a private jet, so you hop on a jet, fly to Paris, just to check out a new restaurant, go to a few nightclubs, walk around, buy your wife something, and fly back the next day. That's how they roll. Well, she got too used to it, got too snobbish, and a couple of times I had to put that group in check. I said, wait a minute. No. I understand it. I walk with you, talk with you, hang with you, party with you, but I haven't forgotten my people. But she forgot her origins and her people, and she got too used to it, too snobbish, and it got to the point that places she used to love to go to eat, she couldn't eat because they were beneath her. So that kind of thing I've seen in too many of the folk, especially on something like the Black Caucus, and especially in some of the local black leadership that forgets who they're supposed to be representing and simply uses their office as a stepping stone into a new level of existence. And maintaining
Judge,
that
they're
level
using
of
their position.
Yeah, becomes more important than what they're supposed to be there to do.
Absolutely. And also, you know, using their position to brokerage power versus, like we were saying initially, using their position to serve the people. And now, you know, oftentimes as well, another thing that happens in politics is, you know, folks tend to help those who have the higher population because they're looking at it from a I need vote standpoint to get in or stay in office. And that's where it becomes conflicting because, okay, take Los Angeles. We have 8% African-Americans. We have 38% Hispanic, 51% Caucasian, and then, you know, Asians and the other minorities fall in between that. I say that to say for somebody who wants to get in office, let's keep it transparent. There's no way that anybody can win. I don't care what race they are off of just 8% of every single black vote. They have to cross over and they have to be able to create policies, initiatives, solutions, and become culture competent to other cultures, especially the Hispanic culture here in Los Angeles. I happen to be black and brown, so I happen to already have a space in my heart where I, you know, I believe in you know, immigration and documentation and certain things for, you know, my brown people as well. But what I'm saying is that there's a positioning that's a good thing, that's a bad thing. What makes it good is, okay, I have to be able to work with different people outside of my culture, outside of what I look like, and I have to be able to get to know their issues and their concerns and then propose what I can do to help this community. Great, great, great for the whole intersectional organization of it. On the flip side, okay, if you're looking at it like I have to be able to gain the votes of the majority voters who voted based on this data, and if they happen to be Hispanic, right, or Caucasian, then guess who again becomes marginalized and despaired when it comes to having their issues addressed? The 8%, which happens to be the black folks. And when you look at the presidential debate, they will talk about black women dying at a much higher rate than white women when giving birth. They will talk about, you know, a black woman flipping states and doing, which I give her kudos for, Stacey Abrams doing these things. What they don't talk about, and if they have, then maybe my ears fell deaf to it on accident. I don't hear them talk about black men or underrated when it comes to their health in general, especially their mental health. But we are, underrepresented when it comes to their health and especially their mental health. But they are overrepresented when it comes to our prisons. When you have black people take up 3.4% of the U.S. population, right? But over half of them were victims of homicide in 2015 when 16% of that 13.4% reported mental health illness, 7 million black people. Why is that not something that we're talking about when we're dealing with presidential debate? You know why? Because that's on a national level. And these people have taken data and they're looking at who voted, who contributed. So who is my audience that I have to talk to? Who is my audience that I have to appease to get my butt in office? Because the folks who really need the help are the smaller percentile. They're the minority. And so they're irrelevant. And that is not okay. But the way it's set up almost puts folks at gridlock because it's going, well, how do I help the people who need help if I don't appease the people who are the majority? Please the people who are doing majority of the voting because they have numbers, Judge. It ain't because just because black folks don't want to vote, okay? It's because they have numbers, just like when we say black people support black businesses. Okay, so let's take LA again. If every single black person, 8%, supported my black-owned business, I still won't be able to feed my family and live a great quality of life just off of 8% of black people when we have 4 million Angelenos, 4 million people who live in the city of Los Angeles. So at the end of the day, if you're looking at a marginalized community, i.e. black community, there's so much more that needs to be done than just black support black, than just, you know, get in office and do what you can for the black folk. Well, even if all of us voted, we're still not the majority for you to give a damn about us when you're talking about our black men when it comes to the presidential debate, when it comes to the State of the Union, when it comes to the City of the Union, even at the city level. Again, there has to be some policy that is created where our community, you know, it can't continue to get looked over because we can't show up in numbers, because even if every one of us shows up, guess what? We still are coming short in numbers. We are very much the minority. And that has to do with everything across the board. So guess what that makes us have to do, Judge? We, systemically, I'm saying makes us have to do, we ain't got to do nothing, but systemically, we have to learn to lock hands with other people and learn their culture at the expense of them learning our culture, right? Or we got to understand how to work with other folks that don't look like us, because guess what? We only 8% when it comes to Los Angeles. We're only 13.4% when it comes to the U.S. population, and half of that is in prison. Okay, hold on. And half of that we're losing to homicide. Oh, hold on. That leaves us down to what, 4%? 6% of black folks who are attempting to rock and roll? So this is where I'm saying it is an uphill climb, and we're having to learn to lock hands with people, because we don't have enough of our people to lock hands with, and it ain't that our people ain't locking hands, and it's not that we're not supporting each other. We don't have the number. And somebody needs to come out and say, listen, instead of victimizing us as being the community or the race or the culture who's lazy and, excuse my language, not doing shit, let's talk about the numbers of how even if every one of us is doing something, that's still not enough when it comes to numbers to push our own agenda. You got the LGBTQ, which I believe it's a human right to love who you want to love, but they had the numbers and the money to push the legalizing gay marriage. Black folks, we don't have that leverage. We're not able to broker our power. We don't have the numbers and we don't have the money to say we're gonna create a black proposition, a black initiative, a black measure. We're going to create AB24 that is for black folks. Where's the funding coming from? And the funding that the government is providing for programs, those programs are to help us reprogram, to get to a place of bettering ourselves, but it ain't enough for us to be able to collectively come together and say, here goes $4 billion, Judge, to push this initiative over and over again until they say yes to us. I mean, come on.
You know what? I saw them start off before they even became LGBTQ. They formed the line back in the late 60s. It was feminism, lesbianism, male homosexuality, the bisexual people, the soy boys or the nerds who couldn't make it in a white man's world even though they were white, and the people that were anti-war that said war is a man thing, so the way to stop war is to change the way boys were raised to men, and if you raised them like girls, they wouldn't be so warlike. So they came together. They got in place. They had a program they used to often speak about of taking control of the media, first the entertainment media, then the communications media, and then they would insinuate themselves into politics and to both parties create chaos and havoc, stage divisive incidents so that they could work quietly while no one was paying attention. So right now in the American population, I think most of the statistics show that LGBTQ bunch is about 5.57% of the American population, less than black folk. But they have insinuated themselves into positions where they have been able to exercise control. Now, for those 55 and over, it's 1.5% to not quite 2, depending upon what survey you look at, or LGBTQ. But interestingly enough, because they have control of the propaganda, but at group 25 and under, they are 16%. Now, we have an equivalent thing that's happened to black people, which is 25 and under and 35 and under. We've got the glorification of dysfunction that has caused us to think like hood rats in terms of ideation as hood rats. In the 60s, if you were a black man who wanted to be somebody, you were going to college. Now, granted, you didn't want a one-year-long expense-paid vacation to sunny, hot, and humid Vietnam, but you were in college. Now you're supposed to be a thug, a gangster, is something you ideate on. There's another problem coming out of that whole bit, too. 25 and under, there are more boy virgins than girl virgins now, and only 44% of the workforce is male. 32% of the undergrads are male, and 36% of the grad students are male, and that's been consistent for the last 20 years. And the worst part of it is this is all ethnicities in this pot. Only 28% on average of each year's high school graduates are male. So the propaganda has had its effect, and as black folk, maybe we need to take a page out of their book and look at it and see how it's done. They are the product of an alliance, and that's why you have all of those alphabets. They were the people that were ostracized, and what they have pulled off effectively is a giant Revenge of the Nerds, part 27. So we need to, I think, form some alliances, but they have to be expeditious alliances and understood to be something that we don't have to have come hell or high water just because. People don't get that, especially the HOTEP type and, the white supremacy freaks who everything is white supremacy, therefore why even bother? And they lapse back into fantasies of the aliens came to Earth 250,000 years ago, made black folk the original Jews, brought them to Egypt, made the pyramids, and then took them to North America where they became the original inhabitants over here. So, I mean, we have all kinds of mythologies and things that we put into our heads. Now, shifting a little bit, what about these mythologies that we have in our heads about reality in terms of how that impacts what we see and how we ideate? Do you see anything that impacts the black clients you have more so than the white ones that is identifiable? And do you see
Absolutely.
Any to the social and political arena with that?
Absolutely. As far as with my clients, what the difference I see between my black clients and my non-black male clients are that, and even female clients, are that, you know, unfortunately, you know, the pattern is of the non-black clients have had someone who they consider, whether it's their parents, their older sibling, aunt, uncle, someone in the household, they consider to be a reputable role model that they mirror and that they look to as to how to be, how to show up in the world, and how to form their identity. When it comes to my black clients, again, male and female, unfortunately, they have looked to outside sources if they could find that to see who they identify with. And then once you find out who you identify with between the ages of 1 and 5, you become hyper-focused on that particular person. And you start to mirror them and you start to do what they do. It's called learned behavior. And then you grow up and you forget that you were between the ages of 1 and 5 when you chose this person. And you forget to unchoose them if they are not something healthy for you as an adult. And then start to choose and create who you want to be as, you know, as an adult. And that's for a lot of people in the community. I know myself as a black young girl, mixed, you know, but black young woman, I didn't have anyone who I looked to in particular as a role model. And that's being transparent. I remember going out into the world and I tend to find a lot of my Latina woman who I look to and said, oh, so that's how I dress. Oh, that's how I do my hair. Oh, that's how I speak. That's how I show up. That's how I be. It wasn't until my adulthood that I start to see black women in rooms and in positions where I'm going, ooh, okay, she looks a little more like me, right? And okay, I think that is a healthy, professional, or sophisticated good quality, I believe, within my perspective that I want to implement into my identity. And so, again, I don't notice a lot of my non-black constituents, friends, or even clients who have that issue, usually it's, oh, my, you know, my mom did X, Y, and Z, or I see my father do X, Y, and Z. And so I mirrored that. I learned that this is how you manage money. This is how you write a check. I'm the oldest of seven. And I remember going to the mall a few years back with my youngest sisters, who are now 15 and 16 and 13, and we were getting ready to pay. And I think she was eight at the time. I taught her how to swipe my card and put in my debit card number, my PIN number. And I did that because I grew up remembering going, wow, I had a lot of love, a lot of support. We were definitely a family. You know, we went to theme parks and we did stuff. We played board games and cards and we watched movies together, but I never talked politics in my house. I wasn't taught how to write a check. I wasn't taught how to use my debit card when it was turned over to me as a teenager. And so these are all things that are life skills. These are all things that create your identity, and they create the trajectory of your success. And honestly, your relationships. And relationships obviously can get you indoors and get you places money will never. And it also predicates what rooms you end up in by your life skills, as simple as life skills. And so a lot of me being the oldest came from figuring out, how in the heck do I do this? How in the heck do I survive? You know, cooking and doing housework, those were things that were mirrored for me in my household. The women were very domesticated in doing those things, but I happened to be a little different in the sense that I was business minded, right? I wanted to go get an education and go all the way to my doctorate. I want to run a business, and I wanted to not just be submissive or just alpha. I want to be alpha submissive. And I learned these things, though, Valerie and Judge, from literally growing up and seeing this outside of my household. And I'm not taking anything by saying that from my parents, who were absolutely, you know, killed the parenting game when it comes to support and love. Still to this day at 38, they empowered me like no one on this earth has. And I know I wouldn't be where I'm at without that empowerment and that support and that love of, you got this, you do this, we got your back, we're supporting you. You know, you're amazing, you're awesome, you're human, you can make mistakes and we won't drop you. And with that, it was my foundation, but there was a lot of moving parts that I had to go out in the world and figure out. And so I find that to be with my Black patients, or Black clients, I should say, that they are figuring that out. I have a guy who's amazing, and he's 61. And he's amazing, Judge. He's amazing, Valerie. But he's just now a 61 trying to figure out, are not even trying, but he's doing it with the work that we're doing together. He's saving himself at 61 from a mother who dropped him, from a father who was a one-night stand. This guy is so courageous to ask for help. He's a Black man at 61 and sit in session and cry and say, I need help. I've been doing this for 61 by myself. Do you know how hard that is to carry weight and be in a dark room some days for 61 years? I won't do it for 5 days because I'm going to go see my therapist or my coach for 61 years. And so when I say that we got to be open to getting this help, because the pathology that I see in the Black men and women who are in sessions with me are heartbreaking at the beginning, but life-changing as we continue to work together. Life-changing. These men are opening up. They're healing their pain pockets. They're telling their story, and they're getting back their power. They're gaining back their power. And so, Judges, and that's where it comes from. And thing is, at the end of the day, listen, whether you grew up in a perfect family household or you grew up in a completely dysfunctional household, at the end of the day, at some point, we all have to figure out how to jump in the water without our life jacket. Two different destinations again, two different journeys again, same destination. You got to figure out how to save yourself at some point. And so this is why I preach and I teach to my clients, Black or human, whatever race they are, that if you were dropped as a child, you're an abandonment young boy or woman, I don't care what race you are, and you grew up to be an abandonment woman or man, and you feel like you got to save yourself, the kid you think grew up perfect, at some point, he got to jump without a life jacket too. Y'all just had two different journeys. But the destination, the figuring self out to jumping without a life jacket and ultimately saving yourself, that day will come for all of us. So this is, I focus on not making certain folks a victim and changing their narrative to, there's things that happen that are traumatizing. We're not going to negate that, but you're not the victim. Okay, you're not the victim. Your journey looks different. But if you and this boy who had a perfect household, which nobody does, can jump in the water without a life jacket together and you can outswim him, you tell me who the victor is. You tell me who the victor is. And it's a perception shift. And I love that you use the word perception, Judge, because it's all in how we perceive things, how we receive it. I don't allow people, and I don't allow my clients to allow people to tell them their narrative. That's not their permission, and they can't do it. You create your narrative. You choose who you want to show up as. And as long as you don't let water get in your ship, you will continue to sail. Water being people's thoughts, their opinions, and their chatter of who you are, what you're doing. Don't let the water get in your ship, and you will continue to sail. And that's what's most important. And my clients, they are so empowered. I had a client send me a message on social media because it's, you know, it was too late to text me. And he's in New York. And so it was like, I don't know, 6 a.m. his time or 3 a.m. my time. And he says, Doc, I thank you for helping me love myself. I'm driving around in my car. He says, I have on the old school El DeBarge playing right now. And it feels really good being in loving me. That is power. This man is a black man working through his stuff, gaining his power, loving himself again, and feeling good about who the hell he is because he's telling his own narrative. He's not allowing people's water to get in his shit, so he's able to sail. And whatever destination he chooses is nobody's business but his. As long as he's proud of it and he can stand in that, then he needs to sail in that direction. And I'm just there to facilitate and empower and to support him in that. And so, again, okay, that's the power.
Let me ask you something.
Go ahead, Doug.
Let me ask you something. You're touching on a thing that I see in some people like Lizzo. Now, Lizzo seems to be trying to fall in love with herself, but the message she's giving to others as an outside influence to make up for the lack of such inside the home place seems to me to be essentially negative. Now, just because you're trying to do it, does that negate the possibility that you're doing it the wrong way? In other words, I run into people that I just deal with that call me. I'm nowhere near where you are in terms of counseling, but that's been my business to help solve people's legal problems, and a lot of legal problems are the result of their personal problems. And I see too many that have gone into, I need to accept myself, but yeah, but you're not a very good person right now. You need to do some self-improvement, and accepting yourself, does that mean that you have to accept your negative rather than where you could be? That you have no cause except nihilism, and instead of being what you ought to be, it's just what you want to be, and what you want to be becomes a byproduct of negativity, and you just decide to be a fat slob like Lizzo having that contest naked out there on a pier with a bunch of men spraying her with champagne from a champagne bottle. Is that good? That kind of feeling good about yourself, or is that just a front for somebody who is deeply in hate with themselves?
I love that I love that you're able to see the two psychology perspectives of it, the psychology behind it. So I want to go back to the acceptance part. I think that when I say to my clients, surrender and accept who you are, where you are, so we can move on, what I'm saying is, take accountability for what your reality is. You know, if you know that you are, you know, not providing for your family and you're not stepping up to the plate, accepting it doesn't mean you make it okay. You're surrendering to the reality of it, saying, okay, I know I'm coming up short. I know that there's more that I could be doing and more that I want to do. I fully accept that. Because only then can you move forward and let that bygone be a bygone. So that is accountability piece of like, look, judge, this is what it is. I apologize. I know I could be doing better. And now let's start to draw up with that better look. That's accountability. That's the surrendering to that. But not accepting that I'm not doing much and I'm just going to stay here. No, absolutely not. That's disempowering and distorted thinking. But as far as like Lizzo, I obviously we don't know, right? We don't have her on the show to say. And even if she was to say, who's to say that's the truth? That can be a mask as well in regard to what you were saying. What I see from observing, I see a woman who has been very broken and very pained because of her aesthetics and not saying if she likes it or not, right? This is what I see, Judge. Hold on. From a little girl, I'm saying this is long-rooted. This is long-rooted pattern with her. This is just happened when she became an artist. But I also see her another side of her. At all. I also see her trying to empower herself and others who have been pained and maybe, traumatized because of them being overweight, because of what they look like, what their body shaming experience is. In addition to that, I think that if she is using her platform to say pretty much F you to those who are body shaming me, I am confident in myself and I am that chick, and that's not really what she internally embodies. That's called avoidant behavior. She's suppressing her pain. And that, Judge, can easily turn into depression, suicidal ideations, which leads to suicide. And that's how a lot of people end up in that dark space of suicide because of what you're saying. Covering up by trying to prove to societal constructs are these folks on social media that you are confident in yourself. You don't have to prove to anybody that you are who you are if you are that. There's a saying that says if you know that you are gifted and you know who you are, you ain't got to fight for the head at the table. When you walk in the room, no matter where you sit or where you stand, the table will shift. And I say that to say if Lizzo feels very confident in that, then she just continues to walk in her confidence. There doesn't need to be a negotiation or a conversation about who the hell she is. So I believe that there is a lot of underlying pain and trauma that she needs to address at the same time that she is empowering herself and others to be in their skin and be proud of who they are. Because I don't think we have permission, Judge, I'm not saying you're doing this, but to tell anybody that they're too fat, too skinny, too tall, too whatever that may be,
Let me interject this. You're absolutely right on one level, but my job for almost 50 years was to tell people what to do, and for the last 16 years of elected office, it was to make people do what they ought to do, whether they liked it or not, because there is a social compact, public peace, dignity, and order that demands that. In other words, at some point, what you want to do may transgress on what you can be allowed to do if others are to be able to do their thing too. So I look at it as all of that's above for their psychological well-being that you just said, but sometimes there's a point where you have to get outside yourself and start thinking about what you ought to be doing and adopt the cause, and if you adopt that cause, you feel a lot better about yourself. Now, I see some white people who don't feel too well about themselves. They've adopted a cause. Black Lives Matter, in terms of as they perceive it, like save the animals, the polar bear and the elephant, the tiger are in danger, so we have to do something about save them. Well, these biped African primates are endangered, so we have to save them. And you see supposed BLM protests, and out of every 11 people, you get 9 little vanilla cupcakes with a few chocolate sprinkles, and they're enraged because they are, what is the term, social justice warriors, out to change things for the better, and some of the things they adopt are not in the interest of the people that they have, but it shows that they too need a cause. And I used to joke about it. Man, did you hear about poor Tommy, no, what happened? Oh, my God, you know, he was going around saying he had no purpose, no cause. I just wish I had listened. Well, what happened? Oh, he just, I just can't say it. He just jumped out of the 28th window of his father's office building. Oh, my God, it was so horrible. Oh, no. I hear that because of a lack of cause, and I hear this other thing, too. Yo, man, you hear about Stomp, man? No, man, what happened, man? We was over Shaw Dogs, man. We had some fire smoke, man. We was hitting on that glass dick, man. Next thing I know, dude all down on the ground, man. Shit coming all out his mouth. Heels was kicking, man. As soon as we cleaned shit up, man, we called 911. It was too late, man. Two buses hard out before he get to the emergency room. Man, that's cold-blooded. I hope his mama don't freak. Ain't that the second one she done lost this year?
Wait,
see,
Judge.
It's all
Judge,
in this.
Interject.
No purpose.
Judge, don't kill me. I got to get on my 2 o'clock because I told you I'm in the California Dim Convention, too. So I got to get my buns
straighten
into
them
another
out.
Reading assumption.
Straighten them out.
I would try my
they
best.
They need some straightening out. Tell them they have people to represent the whole bunch of them and stop just sitting up there profiling. All right? Anyway,
you got it. I love
you
to
ought to be
now.
Our next, you ought to be the first African American woman in line for the White House, not this fake thing we've got from California up there in the insane asylum in the Bay Area. Mrs. Imhoff, that's Carmella. That's a married name.
Love you to pieces.
Yeah, but
I'll talk to
you
guys later.
Thank you for
have
being
a good weekend.
On it's great. Okay.
Okay, sweetie. Bye. Bye, Valerie.
Bye, dear.
Bye. Thank you so much. Appreciate you. Oh, man,
bye.
I hate she didn't have time to promote. That sucks.
You can
find
her.
Okay.
If you Google her, you'll find all kinds of stuff. She's into everything.
I hope you're enjoying this big exclusive via the Judge Joe Brown Show. Don't forget to subscribe to this channel.
This show is sponsored by the Hurricane Reports, merchandise, and more.